Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Philosophy in Action. I'm Greg Perkins, here with philosopher Dr. Diana Shea, where we answer your questions, applying rational principles to the challenges of real life. For those listening to the podcast, please join us live, where there's a text chat to chime in with your follow-up questions and witty comments. The show airs Sunday at 8 a.m. Pacific, 9 a.m. Mountain, 10 a.m. Central, and 11 a.m. Eastern Time at philosophyinaction.com. At the site, you can also submit and vote on questions for upcoming shows and browse the archives from past shows. Now, with all of that out of the way, let's jump over to the star of the show, Dr. Diana Shea.
Happy Sunday.
Welcome, everyone. Arthur, tell us what topics we have on tap today.
We have a great set of questions on honesty under professional confidentiality standards, adopting hobbies just for dating, efficiency in writing, and more.
So if you're listening live, folks, you can post questions and comments in the text chat at philosophyinaction.com/live.
So any news this week before we tackle the questions?
No, actually not, other than that obviously I'm here in San Francisco with you, Arthur, and Andrew and Tom. So having a good time, taking a break, and yeah, that's been awesome. So here we are, still broadcasting though. So that's it. And I just remembered, because Greg is not here, I need to run the conga. So I'm going to go ahead and do that, and then we'll get started.
Question one, honesty under professional confidentiality standards. Do confidentiality standards justify privacy lies? Some professions, like those in clinical psychology, medicine, or law, commonly utilize confidentiality standards that apply between professionals and clients due to the sensitive nature of the information shared between them. Generally, such professionals can and do have a policy of refusing to answer any questions about their clients and so avoid any supposed need for privacy lies to protect from nosy inquiries. However, these standards also often include the understanding, sometimes explicit, that if professional and client should ever meet in a social situation, the professional should follow the client's lead about if and how they know each other. This means that a client could push the professional into a lie. Yet even in the case where both people are basically honest, the mere act of showing recognition of each other could compromise the client's privacy if the professional's job is not a secret. And there are reasonable social situations in which you couldn't hide familiarity without deceit of some kind. So ethically, we seem to be stuck between one, clients having their privacy perhaps violated if they are unlucky enough to encounter the professional outside the office, or two, professionals having to lie to protect their privacy of their clients. Is there another alternative here? If not, what's the best course?
So I want to focus on the therapy context because I'm just not sure that doctors and lawyers would ever have a professional obligation, not to recognize somebody as their client. Maybe, maybe not. But it seems like this comes up much more in therapeutic relationships. So that's what I'm gonna talk about. So in my experience with therapists, these kind of privacy concerns, they're actually discussed in the first meeting, and there's often a very explicit privacy statement which the client signs to say, yes, I understand this is what the policy is, and this idea of, look, I'll follow your lead if we meet accidentally, that's just standard for the profession. That's how therapists work. And I think that's actually going to turn out to be really, really relevant here. Now, personally, like, I'm totally fine with anyone knowing that I'm in therapy and that I'm in therapy with this particular person, obviously, since I'm saying it here on the air, right? But I wouldn't want my therapist to reveal anything about the content of our discussions or anything about her opinion of me, that kind of thing. Now, that's really easy for her to abide by without even the slightest hint of dishonesty, because if somebody pressed her, right, let's say somebody knew that Denise was my therapist and they went and talked to her and said, like, I want you to tell me about Diana. She could just say, like, dude, that's confidential. Well, she wouldn't say it that way, but I would. Dude, that's confidential. Like, I can't tell you. You shouldn't even be asking this. This is inappropriate for you to attempt to cross this boundary. So that's super easy. No dishonesty required. And yet what I'm concerned about with respect to my privacy is definitely protected. But other people might have really big concerns about anyone even knowing that they're in therapy. Right? A person might not want someone to know that they're seeing, say, a sex therapist or a therapist specializing in abusive relationships. So even just knowing, oh, you're a client of this particular therapist could be more revealing than they want. I mean, so just think about this. Maybe the person in therapy is being beaten by their husband or by their wife, and that abuse might escalate if the abuser knew about the therapy. Or the abuser might demand that the therapy cease, and yet the therapy is perhaps, hopefully, instrumental in getting the victim out of the relationship. Maybe the person in therapy has secrets of various kinds. Maybe they have sexual fantasies that are not wrong, but they seem like they would be shameful, or the person has feelings of shame about them. Maybe if other people knew outside, there would be lots and lots of disapproval or misunderstanding of them, and so on. And so the person who is in therapy might fear that the wrong person knowing that they're in sex therapy would result in really unwelcome and even dangerous prying. It might jeopardize their job, it might jeopardize their place in the community. And so.
And you know, actually, I think this applies for a lot of contexts with doctors too, depending on what kind of medical conditions you have, right?
Absolutely.
If you're seeing a specific specialist,
right.
Right, and you suddenly know that person in a social context, that could reveal a lot about any potential medical conditions
right.
you have.
Right, and let's say if there's in the abusive relationship, let's say the wife or the husband, basically the abused spouse, has consulted a divorce attorney. You don't necessarily want that to be out in public just yet. But I don't actually know what the professional standards are for that. I should have asked Tom, but we didn't. But I do at least know in the therapeutic context. I actually think my answer is basically the same. And I think it's important to note that for people who are in these difficult circumstances, where they really, really want their privacy protected in a strong way, they might never seek therapy if the therapist regarded revealing the therapeutic relationship in the case of accidental meaning as morally obligatory. So if you went to a therapist and the therapist said, like, I won't tell anything about what goes on in our sessions, but if, you know, if I'm at a barbecue and we happen to know some of the same people, then I'm going to have to say that you're my client. For a lot of people, that might be like, I'm not doing therapy, and maybe not, I'm not doing therapy with you, but I'm not doing therapy at all. And that would be definitely for the worse.
So does that mean that lying or misleading people in case of accidental meeting between therapist and client is justified?
Not by itself, right? Privacy lies they're really perilous. And I think that they are sometimes warranted if you're caught in an unusual circumstance and you don't have a chance to prepare. Or maybe you're changing your own boundaries of privacy, but that's not this kind of case. Like, this is a kind of case that's predictable and known in advance. So, you know, like, what's going on here? We're talking about having this standard policy of I won't recognize you unless you recognize me. And yeah, that seems like that can involve lying or misleading people in a way that should give us pause. It seems perilous for a lot of the reasons why privacy lies in general are perilous. But the way the right analysis for this situation, I think, is actually analysis like what I say about poker, which is, look, everyone knows or should know that bluffing is just part of the game. So if a person plays poker, they should expect to be deceived, and that's not any kind of moral problem. It's just the context of the game. Similarly, if people know that you're a therapist, then they know, or they ought to know, that you cannot recognize your clients if you happen to encounter them in public by accident. So people just ought to know that therapists and clients might pretend not to know each other. That's how those relationships work. And they work that way because protecting the privacy of the therapeutic relationship is fundamental to that relationship. It's super, super duper important.
Yeah, and I think you can imagine the following thought experiment, right? You introduce your therapist, you don't introduce them, but like imagine you're at a party somewhere and you and your therapist are there and you have lied about how you know this person or you pretended to not know one another and whatever. And then some weeks later, either you tell some friend that was also at this party or someone or that friend finds out that this was actually your therapist and that you had lied. Do you think that your friend would be angry? Probably not.
Well, they shouldn't be, right?
Well, right. But the idea here is that they might more likely be aghast that they had potentially, you know, pried or like, oh, I'm so sorry. Like, I didn't realize. You know, it's not the same kind of response that is often met with lying of the more awful kind.
Yeah. Yeah, I would agree with that. Like these, like it's clear that the person who's telling the lie, like they're just trying to protect themselves in this way. And I think in this very like, oh God, like I don't know what to do kind of way. Like they're not trying to scheme or manipulate. They're not trying to pull one over on somebody or trick somebody. Like they're just trying to protect themselves in this like, and therapeutic relationships, they're super weird, right? They're crazy intimate. You tell this person everything about your like deepest, darkest, innermost thoughts. And yet it's a completely professional relationship. And so it just like, they're trying to protect themselves in the context of that relationship. And I do think that like lots of lies are not of that sort. Lots of lies are, most my lies, I would say, they are manipulative. People are trying to create a false reality for somebody else. They're trying to have their cake and eat it too. But that doesn't seem to be what's going on here. That's not it. They're just trying to keep a part of their life that they're entitled, I think, to have completely private, shrouded in secrecy. Now, that being said, I do think a person can be wrong or mistaken about the need to conceal that they're in therapy. So we might criticize, that actually might be too strong a word. We might say, look, you know, Joe, I think you could have told me this, it would have been okay. So we might criticize a person for making a bad choice about that. But the point is, morally speaking, keeping that relationship, that therapeutic relationship, completely private should actually be an option. Now, I will say one thing that I realized when Arthur was reading the question again, is there are clients who could take pleasure in forcing their therapist to lie in these kinds of circumstances, right? You can imagine, I think this actually happened on, there was some weird, something rather like this on Hannibal, and I was just thinking about this. Now, of course, it's very different if your therapist is actually a cannibalistic serial killer. I just don't recommend that at all in general. But there was some context in which like that he had met a client outside of the office, and the client was like trying to manipulate him into doing something, and I think Hannibal might have eaten him. that didn't work out so well. But the point is that you could have, I mean, like not all clients are morally pure as the driven snow, and you could certainly have a client who would enjoy pushing their therapist into deception in order to like feel like they were controlling them. And if I were the therapist in that context, like, fine, I will play along, and then you will be fired as my client, because that's unacceptable. That's a big problem.
Sure. And, you know, I wanted to comment also, you know, to bring up a parallel with the situation where someone could be wrong or mistaken about their need to tell a privacy lie. I think this is similar to a conversation that we had on a previous show way back when we were talking about privacy lies. And think about how people, it used to be a lot more acceptable, I think, for people to tell privacy lies if there was an inquiry about their sexual orientation.
Right.
And those kinds of standards have changed because the context of our culture and society have changed. And so it's just not a big deal anymore if someone's gay.
Right.
And so, sure, there are situations where it can still be dangerous. I mean, it's not like our culture is all fixed on this score.
Right.
But the point is that in so many contexts, especially in bigger cities, it's just not a big deal anymore. And so I think that the privacy lies is less justified.
Yeah, I would certainly agree with that. Or even just trying to keep it private, like let alone lying about it. But I also like there's still context in which somebody might wish to at least misdirect people in certain ways or just like not talk about it yet. Like let's say if it's something new for them and they live in a small town and it's very religious and they know their family's going to be opposed, there's reasons why at least to say, look, like I need to figure things out for myself before I talk with other people about it. And that like that can involve misleading people in ways I think that are really morally uncomfortable but might be justified.
Yeah. So is there a general lesson here in thinking about honesty?
Yeah. So I think it's important to remember that honesty is not some kind of grim moral duty to speak the literal truth in every circumstance. Honesty, it's the virtue of not faking reality. So honesty is what makes meaningful, trusting relationships based on trade rather than sacrifice of self or others, makes those relationships possible. It's what keeps us focused on the facts rather than trying to control and manipulate people by spinning fantasies. these kinds of things, this is what honesty does for us. It's a self-interested virtue, as all of the actual virtues are. So if you're in a situation where it seems like being honest would require the sacrifice of yourself or others, you need to take a deep breath and take a step back and take a second look. Ask yourself whether you're really trying to get some unearned value by deception. If you're not, then you're probably okay, but you know, if you're not sure and you can't figure it out, submit another question to me. I will do my best to answer it. Yeah, go ahead, Arthur.
Yeah, and I think the point here is to make sure you're really clear in your mind that about the difference between dishonesty and lying, right? I think you have to think about what the pitfalls are of lying or being misleading in some kind of cynical and inappropriate way. All the things like having to spin a web of lies, trying to extract a value from others, things that involve damage to your reputation or trustworthiness. I think a really good litmus test for whether a particular lie leads to or is an instance of dishonesty is, you know, how would people react when they discover the lie, right? And that's not the whole, you know, matter, right? There are a lot of people who might not have a problem with lying that actually is a problem.
Or vice versa.
Right. But the point is that you can at least use that as a clue in your thinking about privacy lies. You know, if someone is more readily going to say, oh, I'm so sorry, I didn't mean to ask an invasive or very private question, versus when someone says, dude, that's really not cool. Like, why would you have lied to me about blah?
Right.
Like, that's a good clue for you about whether you're trying to lie in this dishonest way or whether a lie is at least compatible with the requirements of honesty.
Right, right. I think in general, there's a conceptual framework that's useful here that you reminded me of, that just as there's a difference between killing and murder, there's a difference here between dishonesty and lying. And actually, there's actually quite a number of things that are dishonest that don't involve explicitly telling untruths. And so I think that's worth remembering. There's a lot of ways to be misleading in seriously morally problematic ways that even though you're technically telling the truth. And I think one has to be alert to that, just as one has to be alert to situations in which, look, I'm not going to be telling the truth here, and that's not a moral problem.
To say nothing of all the ways you can be dishonest, not even involving other people.
Very true. Very true.
So what's your take-home point?
My take-home point? Oh, I totally forgot about that. Hang on a second. Okay, so professional standards to protect the privacy of a relationship between therapist and client are not dishonest and perfectly justified. They make the therapeutic relationship possible, and because everyone knows or should know those professional standards, failing to recognize a client in an accidental social meeting is no more dishonest than bluffing in poker.
All right. Let's see if I can find any follow-up questions.
There's one from Tom at the bottom.
Yeah, are sexual preferences any less sacrosanct as private admissions to the therapist as other personal thoughts?
No, but I think in general people regard sexual matters as more, people tend to regard those as more in the realm of private than otherwise. Does that make sense? People can regard anything as super private, and legitimately so. Like, any aspect of their life could be something that they're like, this is not something I want to talk about people with in general. This is not something I'm comfortable with. And it just so happens that sexual preferences is going to be one of those issues for lots of people, particularly when there's lots and lots of cultural opposition to it.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Yeah.
All right. Well, seeing no other questions, it's time for a reminder about the tip jar.
So Philosophy in Action Radio, not just the live show, but the podcast too, is available to anyone free of charge. That's because we want to spread rational principles far and wide. We do that with every show to thousands of listeners, but we can't accomplish that alone. We do rely on the support of our fans. So if you value our work, please do contribute to our tip jar. You can visit philosophyinaction.com/support to send money online or via the mail. We suggest $5 per episode or $20 per month, but any amount is welcome. You can also create a recurring monthly tip via PayPal, Dwolla, or your bank's bill pay. then you don't need to remember. You get free access to Philosophy in Action's premium content, and we really, really appreciate that regular support. Again, you can do that over at philosophyinaction.com/support.
Question two, adopting hobbies for just dating. Is it wrong to take up a hobby for the sake of dating? I'm single and I want to meet more women. Is it wrong or unwise to take up hobbies like dancing, acting, painting, singing, or guitar just to have some skill to show and to meet women interested in those activities? I wouldn't take up these activities without the dating angle. I'm just not interested in them, at least not right now. Is that wrong?
So I find this question, it's both amusing and strange. I think there's some factual misunderstandings here about how one would generally pursue new hobbies, and there's also just some misunderstandings about what would be effective for dating. So
let's talk about the process for taking up new hobbies first.
Yeah, because I think it's worth being clear on that. I think that'll clear up the hobbies in the context of the dating question. So in general, a person doesn't take up new hobbies. Some new hobby, knowing that he's going to absolutely love it, right? Instead, what you do is you try something out that seems likely to fit what you're wanting at that particular time. Sometimes it's very different from what you expected, so you drop it. Other times it's way, way better than expected. It's more fun, it's more interesting, it's more engaging, whatever. And so it sticks. Basically, you stick with it, and maybe even your interest increases over time. So you would have thought, well, look, I've want to do like maybe one salsa class a week, and you end up doing it four times a week instead, right? So either way, there's a kind of discovery process. You find out better what you like and what you don't like in the process of actually trying it. There's no like rationalistic deduction to be done here. You have to have the experiences to figure out whether you're actually going to enjoy this activity or not. And when you're doing this, when you're trying to figure out, well, what is it that I want to do? What's an option? What's a good option for me right now? What should I try? It's perfectly legitimate to consider elements other than the hobby itself, like other than the substance of the hobby, what you're actually doing, when you're considering whether to do it or not. So you don't just think, well, do I enjoy singing? Okay, maybe I want to take up singing. You can think about things like, well, how much fun am I going to have as a beginner? How long is it going to take to become reasonably proficient or let alone expert? How expensive is it? How much time is it going to take? Does the schedule of it fit mine? Is it going to be an aid to other projects and pursuits of mine? And also another thing that you consider is it going to have social benefits? Am I going to meet people in it? Is that something I want? Because maybe you don't want to meet people at all. Am I going to meet people, and am I going to meet the kind of people that I like? So these are all legitimate questions. And so basically, when you're choosing to try out a new hobby, think about not just whether you will like the activity or not, but how well it will fit into your overall life, your overall goals here.
Yeah, so what about trying a new hobby for the sake of meeting women or men?
Yeah, or men.
Or any kind of prospective partners?
Right. That should not be your primary motivation, right? You should be interested in the hobby for its own sake. You should want to better yourself. You should have this kind of growth mindset motivation about what you're actually doing, the activity that you're engaged in. But of course, within the range of potential interests, you can reasonably consider whether this or that hobby will help you better advance your secondary goal of meeting people, and particularly meeting women to date, if that's your particular thing. You absolutely should not pursue an activity that you're not really interested in just to meet women. So, like, there are certain activities that are heavily dominated by women. Like, theater tends to be heavily dominated by women. A knitting circle is probably going to be heavily dominated by women. Well, women and maybe hipsters, I don't know.
There are a lot of men in theater, too.
There's, from what I know from people, I had a roommate in L.A. in theater, and she's like, it's like 90% women.
Huh.
Yeah. And a lot of the men in theater were also gay, so that was not helpful to her. And like riding horses, particularly English riding that I do, it's 95% women. So like you want to meet men, don't take up eventing. That's not the thing to do. I mean, if you do that, if you try to pursue an activity that you're really not interested in because, oh, look, it just has a really good male to female ratio or female to male, whatever you want, you are going to be unhappy with this. You are not going to do well in the activity. You are not going to be attractive to the women doing the activity. because they will know that you don't like it. It will be obvious to them that you are just there to meet them, and you will seem mercenary and you will seem creepy.
Yeah, and I definitely agree with that aspect of it when you're really there, even though you don't enjoy the activity. But you mentioned earlier something about how if it's a secondary interest, I mean, the social element of it or meeting new people can be the secondary interest, but maybe shouldn't be the primary. And I think it just depends on how that manifests for you. So you can definitely take up an activity with the express, explicit primary purpose to meet people, right? For dating, sex, whatever, right? And I think that that's totally fine, but it just depends on how you conduct yourself in this activity. Yeah, you can definitely come off super creepy if you're going to be there and every time anyone says or does anything, you kind of try to angle it in a certain direction. I mean, like, yeah, that's going to be problematic.
Right.
But I think that once you're, even though your fundamental motivation for being there can be, again, dating, sex, whatever, you can really enjoy the activity for its own sake once you're there.
Right. If you can do that, that's fine. The problem is if you don't really.
Yeah. And I think it has to be the sort of thing that you could have a primary interest in the activity itself. For example, if you're naturally athletic and you enjoy sports, and there's a particular sport maybe you're not that excited about as a sport, but like it's a fun recreational thing to do. You can go and participate in this if you think that it's going to increase your odds of meeting compatible people. And even though you might not be that interested in that specific sport, but you're in this sporty context and you're going to enjoy it because it's a fun recreational thing anyway. And so you're going to derive like what I want to call this first-handed enjoyment out of the sport itself. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think it's, there's just this difference of, will you enjoy the activity or not, or will it be a tough, painful slog because you're like knitting?
Right.
Who would want to do that?
I know a lot of people, including some of whom are in this room.
I actually like knitting, so I'm not objecting to it. And I know quite a number of men who enjoy knitting too, because there's no reason why that should be sex specific.
Right.
But and I kind of like a man who would actually knit. Like, that's kind of cool. I don't know. Yeah. Like Tom.
That's what I was looking at.
Yeah, I know. I didn't actually think that Andrew was a knitter. That didn't. The other point that I wanted to make here is, look, if you're just starting a hobby, you are really, really not likely to be impressing women with your skill anytime soon. Like, really not. So what you should do is aim to impress the women that you're doing this activity with your enthusiasm, with the questions that you ask, with the effort that you're going to put in. But again, that requires an actual interest in the activity. So like, if you think you're going to take up guitar and in 6 weeks of lessons be able to serenade women at their, you know, underneath their windows, well, that might be a bad idea anyway, but nonetheless, like, that's not going to happen. That's not how that works.
Yeah, and I think the difference here is something that is in the question itself, which is, are you trying to learn the skill to impress women or whoever, or are you trying to participate in an activity where you can also meet people, right? Like,
right.
That distinction is really important here, right? So, and that's why you're probably not going to pick up guitar skills, you know, that are impressive anytime soon, like you said. But at the same time, if you took up a guitar class and you met people through it, like, your skill level is not necessarily that important.
Right. Right. Yeah. Impress them with your process virtues, not
with your
results.
Growth mindset.
Yes. Impress them with your growth mindset.
Yeah.
Yes.
So you've just taken up Krav Maga. Any lessons there?
Yeah. So for me, I definitely had particular purposes about doing a martial art. Like, I wanted to learn to use my own strength. I wanted to learn to like move people around with my body. And I'm definitely like enjoying learning the skills. I'm also really enjoying, there's this super duper positive way that the teaching happens at Colorado Krav Maga that I really like. And that's actually been informative and helpful for me to experience that for various reasons. But it is also partly a social activity. It's partly a get out of the house activity. And it's also the case that I like women who prefer the company of men to the company of women. Those are the kinds of women that I like to hang out with, and those are the kinds of women who like to hang out with me. And so I like male heavy activities, A, because I generally prefer to hang out with men. But then I also, in those activities, I find women doing those activities who I actually like and wish to hang out with. And so Krav is male heavy, male dominated, but a class is maybe 70-30 or 60-40 men to women. And the women tend to be, you know, they're not wallflowers. They're not that usual catty type. They're pretty badass. And that, so like, that's good for me. It means that like, A, I get to hang out with men a bit more, and I get to hang out with the kind of women that I like. And that's like, that works for me. And I know that that's a pattern that's worked for me. It's one of the reasons why I liked working in tech after college. It's one of the reasons why I like doing firearms training and other kinds of things that are male dominated, but there are women in there, and they tend to just be the kind of women I like. So like those kinds of things, those kind of social goals definitely mattered to me. I wouldn't have wanted to do something home alone. That would not have satisfied. Even if I could have learned things faster, that wouldn't be what I want. So that's okay. Like, it's okay to have these secondary and tertiary goals, but you still, like, you have to be interested in the activity itself.
So what's your take home point?
So, don't attempt to meet women by taking up hobbies that bore you. That's really a losing strategy. Instead, figure out the hobbies that actually do interest you and pursue your social goals as secondary purposes. Although I guess, like, I would agree with you, you can pursue it as it can be your primary purpose, but you have to enjoy the activity.
All right, let's see if there are any follow-up questions here.
Oh, there's one by Tom Jones here.
Is Diana's preference for male-dominated activities related to some form of sexism?
He says, not trolling, really curious. I also prefer male-dominated activities. I just think that there's a certain set of sex-related differences in how men and women tend to act. And there's certain qualities of women that I really like. There's certain qualities of men that I really like. But there's particularly, you get a lot of women together, and there tends to be a certain amount of catty behavior and indirectness and backbiting that I find extremely unpleasant.
So your answer is basically yes.
It's not that they have to be that way. It's just that they are.
Truth is a defense to sexism.
And I'm a very assertive person as well, and men tend to be able to handle that, and women can't. At least a lot of women can't. So that matters. I don't think that's sexism. I think that's just recognizing the kinds of people that you tend to like.
I think it's also very dependent on the kind of culture that we have and what kinds of gender roles or gender norms are prevalent.
Right. And also, like, it's different. Let's say if there was a... Like, I found in the CrossFit gym that I belonged to some years ago, it was, because it was a female trainer, we had a lot of women in the gym, and that was not this kind of catty atmosphere, because like, the kinds of women who are doing that activity are not the kinds of women who are going to be weird and catty about those kinds of things.
Thanks for mansplaining.
Anyway, there's another one from Tom Jones a bit earlier too.
Yeah, that was also a good one, I think. And I think it relates to one of the things that we were already talking about. Do you think it's a good idea to pursue any kind of activity with a goal of finding a date? Is there anything to the old wisdom that you have to stop looking for a mate and start focusing on yourself and your dreams, and a mate will happen eventually?
I think that's a false alternative. And actually, I've realized that I should have put in a note about my podcast on Finding Good Prospects for Romance and Friendship, which is available for, I believe, $10. And you can find that over at philosophyinaction.com/romance podcast, I believe. I'm sorry, I don't have the link handy. I'll put that in the show notes. So in that, I talk about these kinds of issues. And it's not that you are, let's say, you are going to go try Taekwondo with a goal of, like, I want to ask somebody out on the first class.
Maybe not on the first class, but, you know, eventually.
But you don't want to go in there like, okay, who is it that I'm interested in now today in class? Like, I just think
No, I think that's totally legitimate.
Let me finish my thought, and then maybe I'll let you go. Maybe I'll let you say something. I don't think that one should go in there with this kind of mercenary attitude, so you're not focused on the activity, but instead focused on your dating goals. But on the other hand, just because I don't think that doesn't mean that you should instead just like not think about dating at all and just like try to live your life and then maybe love will happen to you. No, you do have to be purposeful about it. You have to actually pursue this as a goal. But I think that the way to do this is to expose yourself to lots and lots of people in context in which asking somebody out would be appropriate. Figure out what you want and then actually like, yeah, have the balls, but that might not be the relevant genitalia. Have the gumption to actually, you know, ask somebody out for coffee or something like that. So don't be either mercenary or passive. There's a way of being reasonably purposeful about this that is not going to either creep people out or ensure that you will be single forever.
Yeah, I agree. And I think focusing on yourself and your dreams involves going out and pursuing activities, and that can oftentimes have a certain social dimension, and so that you're actually doing something in that case,
right,
that facilitates finding a mate.
Yes.
There's another question here that I think is kind of interesting, also from Tom Jones. Is it manipulative to try to apply DISC types to the process of finding a mate?
No, I think that's just a damn good idea. I think that you can know, like, I need somebody who's more assertive, and I need somebody who's less assertive, or I need somebody who's more people-oriented or more task-oriented, or sorry, more thing-oriented. I think that particularly the assertiveness issue, as I don't know, maybe I think about this more because I'm a highly assertive woman, and so like somebody who's low on the assertiveness scale, I think that just doesn't work for me ultimately, and knowing that is useful. I also think that, let's say, if you're a man who's very thing oriented, trying to date somebody who's very, very people oriented, like that could be a mismatch. That could be a problem. Or maybe you want some of that, but not in the extreme, because some of it could be helpful to you. So I think that's worthwhile. I don't think that one should be locked in. You shouldn't say, well, look, I need somebody who's you know, high I, little bit of D, and no S, like that. That's not going to work. But I think that you can certainly use DISC to identify people's personality traits quicker and rule some of them in or out quicker in the process of looking for potential friends and potential romantic partners.
Yeah, I would just say be very careful, because you know, you might have an idea in your mind about what kind of DISC qualities you want someone to have, and you could be very mistaken about that.
Yes. Yeah. Okay.
All
ready
right.
To move on?
Yeah. Question 3, efficiency in writing. How can a person improve his productive output in writing? How can he measure and increase his efficiency in writing, whether for blog posts, essays, papers, or anything else? Should a person set a goal of completing a given writing in a given time frame? Should he track time spent? Should he limit editing or something else?
Yeah, so I will say this is a problem not just with writing, but it's a problem with lots of kinds of work, including programming work, I think. So you might find lots of good advice in books and articles, not just on writing effectively or writing efficiently, but also on programming too, and how to do those kinds of projects and get them actually done in reasonable amounts of time, which is obviously a huge, huge business issue, and lots of people are thinking about how to do that effectively. So I am going to give some advice here, and it's going to be a bit haphazard just based on my own experience and so on, but I think that this is the kind of thing that you can find pretty good advice out in the culture on.
Yeah, so let's go through it.
Let's go through it. Okay. So first of all, I think you need to identify what your goals are here. Do you want just lots and lots of output, even if sometimes that's of lower quality? Is that okay? Or do you want high quality output only? Do you want to be publishing a blog post every day? Do you want to be on a regular production schedule? You know, like whatever it is, figure out what your actual goal is and then create systems and deadlines and ways to work around those goals. I think that that's actually really, really critical. So that's the first thing. Second thing I think is it's often helpful to create a kind of standard process so that you know both where you are in the process at any given time with any given project, and also it helps you identify where you tend to have problems, and you can figure out how to solve those problems. So for writing, at least for me, generally I have a planning stage, I have a first draft, I have a second draft, I have a final round of editing, and I have a copy editing round. Now, it's not that, I will say, I'm not super strict about that, but I have that in general, like, okay, I know where I am in my editing process. And I know, for example, that for me, writing that first draft is agony. That's horrible. I also know that by the time I get to copy editing, I'm so freaking done with the project that I just want it to be over. I just can't take it anymore. So knowing that, like, I try not to have too many things that I'm copy editing all at once, because that's, or doing first drafts on all at once, because that's too painful. I tend to procrastinate. So, like, it's nice if I can be in the first drafts or in the second draft stage, which is actually, like, that feels really good to me, and not, you know, not be doing the harder stuff all the time. So I try to space out my projects in that way. Another thing that you can do is schedule specific blocks of time for work. I did this when I was writing my dissertation, that initially, like, one of the things that I've read a bunch of books on how to actually finish a dissertation, which is something that lots of people don't do. And so one of the things that they recommend was writing at specific times, like blocking out, let's say, 10 to 2 every day. This is my writing time. And they said, like, look, it's not that you have to sit down and actually be productive then, but you have to sit at your freaking desk and do nothing else other than writing. Because you're like, don't, you know, so don't, if the writing isn't working, you don't get to go check Facebook instead, right? So the idea is you're trying to train yourself to say, like, look, this is my block of writing time, and this is what I'm doing. And setting aside time for that can often be really helpful for people, so that they're not procrastinating, they're not trying to do a bunch of other stuff. What I found particularly important, I did that for a little while, that helped get me in the habit. What I found particularly important was to work on this dissertation every freaking day, even if it was only for 15, 20 minutes. That helped keep it in my active memory, because if I let it go even for 2 days, if it was 48 hours, if I skipped a day, things would leak out of my head, and then it would take 20 minutes, if not longer, to get myself back into figuring out where I was in the writing. And that process of getting myself back in is both extremely painful and time consuming. And so if I just kept it going day to day, worked on it even a little bit, that made a big difference in my ability to move forward the next day. I think it's important to track your progress in some way. You can either track it by process, meaning tracking time, or tracking output, meaning words or pages. You can also track both. There is always a danger with this of getting too much of what you measure, meaning you can accomplish very little but put in the hours, because that's what you're tracking, or you can write pages and pages and pages of absolute crap because what you're tracking is the pages and not the quality of the output. So again, it might be useful here to know where you are in what stage, to say, okay, I wrote, you know, 6 pages, but it's really not yet second draft material. I'm still in the first draft phase. And so, you know, that can be a way of making sure that you're actually doing effective, productive work.
You know, and one thing that you can try is actually seeing if you can kind of gamify it for yourself. Especially if your work can be broken up into discrete phases. So, for example, you suggested planning, first draft, second draft, final editing, and so on. Mm-hmm. You can see what you can track your velocity through each of those stages, right? Because from a certain perspective, you can imagine, like, you'll have certain kinds of standards for what you expect first, second, etc., to actually live up to. So it kind of helps get over this potential pitfall here of getting too much of what you measure, right?
Right.
And so what you're really seeing is, like, how quickly can I output something that meets my standards for, like, the planning phase, the first draft phase, the second draft phase, final editing, and so on. And I think that can definitely be really helpful. And I know that there are a lot of apps that you can use that will help with that kind of thing. So the particular style that might be appropriate here, especially if you might potentially have several different writing projects in flight at the same time, is like a Kanban board. If you don't know a lot about that, I recommend you look into it, K-A-N-B-A-N. And there's a specific, I think, free app called Trello, T-R-E-L-L-O, that helps to visualize this. And it's about moving work through phases. It's one of the agile methodologies that a lot of software development companies use as well. But in any event, that can really help you not only to visualize your progress over a couple of different projects, but also help you to see what your velocity is.
Cool. I will put do some Googling and put some of that in the show notes for people. Okay. Another thing you can do is, if you want to get better at estimating how long writing will take, work on actually doing that. So for every project, make an estimate and then track how you actually did with that. And that can be really good. I also think it's really, particularly with writing, one of the ways in which projects for me have taken way, way longer than they should have was I had too much of an idea in my head of I want to be done with this project in, say, 3 months. And so I would go over it and I would be unsatisfied, but I didn't want to fix the problems because that I sort of vaguely saw in the back of my head because they were too big. This is particularly when I was editing my dissertation into a book. And so the problems were too big. And so I didn't, because I had this idea, like I want to finish this quickly. I want to do this light editing. I don't want to make this a major project. I didn't finish, I didn't make these big, big changes. But then as a result of that, I was unhappy with it and I was unwilling to publish it. And so as a result, basically I just did a bunch of editing passes in this like allegedly final editing stage when I really needed to treat it more as a second draft and go back. So sometimes things don't work out quite in the way that you think. And if you keep trying to push on things, you can actually make things slower. If you keep trying to like push it through the process when it's really not ready yet, it can make things slower. So beware of that. Another thing you can do is use accountability buddies, which is something I certainly do, and with Arthur and Andrew. So they can help focus you, they can help you set goals, they can make very, very objective whether you succeeded or failed. At
accountability buddies, mine. Andrew and I are not volunteering.
Yeah. You can also create artificial deadlines if natural ones are not easy. So this can definitely be really, really helpful. And like we have a certain process, a fairly intense process, in that we have a Skype meeting every morning, 6 a.m. here Pacific time, 7 a.m. Mountain, which I'm glad I got the better end of that bargain. And then we have a weekly planning meeting on Sundays and so on. But even sometimes I've done this where I'm having a really unproductive day and I will either ping you or Andrew and say like, I'm getting nothing done. Like I need to do this. Ping me in 2 hours about whether I've gotten it done or not. And that I will actually get done. And I think there's interesting questions about why this works, whether it's a sense of shame or secondhandedness. I actually don't think though. I think it makes what it does in large part is make success or failure very, very apparent to you and very objective, and you cannot fudge it because it's just in your own brain again. But other things that you can do that would be similar would be creating tracking spreadsheets, creating creating a calendar, just something physical that you would see it next to your computer that would, how much work did you actually do? I actually recently created a writing spreadsheet that tracks my average minutes of writing per day per day where it's on days. There's certain days that I'm deliberately taking off and those don't get counted against me. And I did this based on, Andrew actually had a spreadsheet for piano practice that was on this model. And so what I'm looking for, I like this because what I'm looking for is for the number of average minutes per day for the year to be going up slowly. So I'm not looking for grand change. I'm just looking for incremental progress. And so that seems to, that's motivating. That's helpful. It's not setting myself an unrealistic goal. It's just looking for a little bit of betterment there.
Yeah, and I know that I'm pretty biased on this point. I think anybody who knows me at all knows that I basically measure and track all the things all the time. But, you know, and maybe in certain respects, I go overboard compared to what the practical value is of certain things.
You think?
Shut up. But I think that there can still be tremendous value, even if it's not direct, from a lot of kinds of measurement, and things that you might not even expect in advance. So, for example, I measure, this is, you know, tangential here, but for example, I measure all the food that I eat with, you know, pretty great granularity. And I'm not currently doing any kind of diet where I'm limiting number of calories or worrying about specific macronutrient breakdowns or whatever. I'll be doing that again soon. But my point is that I'm still measuring everything. And I think that this helps me to get a really good intuitive sense of how the amount of food and the kind of food that I'm, you know, shoveling down my throat, how that compares to the actual caloric totals or macronutrient breakdowns. Because as I'm entering it into my FitnessPal, you know, I'm kind of seeing that. And so I develop the sense for that. And I think a similar kind of thing could be relevant in any kind of area that's amenable to measurement, whether it's what you do at the gym or how many hours of writing you output or how many words you output or what have you. I think just by measuring it, you've kind of made it more objective, less kind of willy-nilly like, oh, I feel like I did enough today, or like, you know, you can imagine, you know, my saying, oh, I feel like I ate enough or not enough today or whatever, but unless I could actually look at something or unless I really developed that sense, I wouldn't really know. And that helps, and I think, like I mentioned earlier, it can definitely be helpful to try to gamify things for you, and just the sheer act of measuring something can create that kind of internal motivation, like, oh, I'm going to beat my score yesterday.
Yeah, and I noticed that there's just this big gap between the objective fact of the matter and my subjective impression on a lot of things. So both for how much work did I do today, if I meet a deadline or if I meet a goal. Yes.
So one of the things that you do have to watch out for, and Diana did mention this before, though, is that you become good at what you're measuring. So particularly with the piano practice, there was a time early in the process where I realized that I wasn't actually getting a lot of value per minute time because I was so focused on the thing I was measuring, which was the actual time output only. So the way I balance that now is that actually per session, I will have a very specific goal as to what I want to accomplish within this session, which is sort of measured against how much available time I have. And it's a little bit ambitious usually, but that's helped calibrate me to not falling into this pit of just checkmarking.
Yeah, low quality
checkmarking and
right.
Then moving on.
Right.
So that is something you do have to watch out for.
Yeah, but I find that the reason that tracking is helpful is because there's this disconnect between the objective fact of the matter and my subjective impression. So I found both with food, because I'm actually doing food tracking too in my FitnessPal, and it's definitely true with hours. So sometimes I feel like I would judge like how much I ate today by how hungry I am throughout the day. But there can be days where I eat 1500 calories and I'm like, whatever, I'm not hungry at all. And then there are days when I eat 3000 calories and I'm super freaking hungry all the time. And so like the fact of the matter about what I ate is very different from how it feels to me. And similarly with tracking hours, there are times when I did 45 minutes of work and I feel like I got a ton done because I finished the thing that I was trying to do. And then there are times when I work 10 hours and feel like I got nothing done, even though I was extremely productive, because I didn't actually get to that end point that I wanted to do. So that's why I think it's really important to do this kind of tracking and to do a kind of tracking that works well for you. And I think you're going to have to experiment with that. Experiment. That's my basic advice, because a lot depends on what works for you and what works for your own personality and what doesn't. And so that matters here.
So what's your take home point?
If you want to become more efficient in writing, then try various techniques to become more productive generally and see what works. Like, honestly, lots of experimentation.
All right. I saw a few follow-up questions here. So Yeah, first one, again from Tom Jones. Do you have specific advice for high eye people whose efficiency problems might be more related to finding a new shiny?
I don't have this at all. Not at all. No, that's totally wrong. I have this in spades.
I have this and I'm not a high eye.
So I think that one has to become very diligent in the art of saying no, including saying no to yourself, which is really hard. And actually, Paul was really helpful for this because he's so good at refusing new commitments. Whereas I'm like, oh, that sounds like fun, let's do it. And then I become overloaded and things get dropped and so on. And I talked to him about this. Now, I think he's on the opposite end of the spectrum. He needs to learn how to say yes more often. At least that's my opinion, but he might disagree. But he basically said, like, his default answer is no. And he has to be convinced to say yes of something. And when he's thinking about, does he have the time to do this, he thinks about the screwing off that he likes to do. Like, he thinks about, I'm not willing to give up time playing around on Facebook to do this thing, so therefore it's not going to happen. So,
And I'm not willing to give up time measuring things.
because that's so much fun. Oh gosh.
Different strokes for different books.
Yeah. So anyway, so I think that for one, the art of saying no, I think being very focused on here's what I'm supposed to do, having an accountability buddy can be really helpful. I think there is this problem with the work ethic for high eyes. I certainly experienced this. And so you have to work on setting yourself goals and accomplishing them and investing yourself in the great feelings that come with actually getting things off of your plate.
Yeah, Tom Jones has a follow-up question here about what's entailed in this accountability buddy idea, and I think we talked about it a little bit.
Yeah, I think so basically the idea is that you have another person to whom you are saying, here's what I'm planning to get done. And then you have some kind of check-in, and that person is like, did you do the things? And if you did, they go yay, and if you didn't, they go boo, and I'm so ashamed of you, and how dare you do it? How dare you not do all the things?
Maybe not so much with a shame, but there can oftentimes be penalties imposed. So, for example, depending on, it could be either like a consistent every violation is a certain amount of dollar penalty or something else, or sometimes just it's only certain things that you might agree on in advance will have that kind of penalty. This could be one way or it could be two way, right? Like you can have accountability buddies accountable to one another
Yeah, I
for
think it works
things.
better as two ways. But I also like you and I, so like I'm your like non-work getting things done accountability buddy, but you're my health and fitness one. So
Right.
like there's still it's an accountability buddy relationship, but it's asymmetrical in terms of what we're doing. But I think there's lots of ways of doing this. I feel like I should answer a separate question on this at some point, but it would
Sure.
be worth doing. Yeah.
Yeah. And then KPM has a very concrete question here. Have you tried a structured writing approach? It's often good to set goals for a sketch out content, then build a map before actually writing out the content.
So I want to punch people who propose this.
But not you, KPOM.
No. Like I understand this method works for lots and lots of people. It does not work for me. And I kept trying to fit myself into this mold again and again and again for decades. And it just never ever worked for me. I will write an outline, which is extremely messy. There's actually an example of it on my blog of outline of a section for my dissertation that was on Hume's particular form of determinism. And it's a freaking mess. It's like barely it's I can I mean I can look at it and go, okay, this is what I was wanting to do, but it's not some neat, nice outline, nothing like that. It can't be. I cannot write an outline. What I have to do is take that mess and put that into a first draft and then work from there. I cannot do this planning in advance. It does not work. I get completely stuck. And it was only finally when I finished the dissertation, having used my own methodology here effectively to write it in a reasonable amount of time, that I finally truly gave up on this. Well, I should be doing it in this more planning kind of way.
Yeah, I think everybody needs to figure out what's going to work for them because for me, by contrast, I love outlines. And the way my writing process works typically is I'll write a very broad outline, right? Like, here are the three or four sections that I'm going to have. And then I go into each of the sections and I kind of dig a little deeper. I'm like, okay, and in this section, I'm going to write some stuff. I'm like, and then I kind of like move in stuff from my brainstorming. Because,
right.
Sorry, I should have prefaced this with like, brainstorming is oftentimes really valuable for me to just like get as much like dumped out of my brain as possible, like hear all the things. In fact, like I'll do this with Facebook comments. Like I'll write little notes for myself in the comment, you know, about like, oh, I want to say this thing, and I want to say this thing, and I want to say this thing.
Yeah.
And then I finally like find a way to work it in. But when I'm doing like, proper writing, so like I said, I'll eventually get it into, you know, this very high level outline, and then I'll fill in a little bit more detail, and then like a little bit more detail. And just depending on how complex the piece is that I'm writing, eventually I'll just flesh it out, right? And then so instead of this one sentence saying the topic that I want to talk about, like that's where I'll actually like fill in the paragraph. And then so I kind of go through and fill it in, and then like maybe I realize it's not really working out so much in this structure, and so like I rearrange it a little bit. But in my mind, it's always based on like this outline and structure and
right. Yeah. Oh God, I can't do that. And I will go from the like section by section, I will make my sort of map a little bit more detailed, but what happens is I'll be writing this draft and I get stuck at some point and I'll realize that I've run into a kind of conceptual problem. And so I will go back and reread and do some editing and realize, oh, I went left here when I needed to go right. And then I'll go right and keep going. But it's a very intuitive process. It's not a planning process for me at all. And you have to figure out what actually works for you. And I hope that, right.
I knew you weren't a very high J. I knew.
Yeah, I don't know that this is a high J kind of thing.
I'm just teasing.
Anyway, I know. I will never be high J enough for you. Anyway, so I just think you really have to respect what actually works for you, and I think that's really important here, and probably the most fundamental bit of advice that I would give is stop trying. Don't try to force yourself to do something that doesn't work for your own personality. Oh, hang on a second. I'm supposed to conga.
Rapid fire questions. It's time to put Diana in the hot seat. I'm asking questions from the rapid fire queue and questions that you post right now in the chat too. Diana doesn't know what questions will be asked, and I will try to trip her up. I don't know what questions are going to be asked because I have not looked at these in advance
you
either.
You haven't. Yeah, so I think we should just do one or two since we're actually over time now.
I actually kind of like some of these first ones. Is there value in naturalistic literature? Can naturalistic literature still be heroic at its core?
Yes, and probably not. So I think that it's really hard for naturalistic literature, and here I would think of, let's say, like Thomas Hardy, who is wonderful and fabulous and very naturalistic, but it's not heroic. That's not what it's doing. I guess I have yet to see heroic naturalistic literature, and maybe I'm just not thinking of some things, or maybe I'm some things I haven't, you know, some things I haven't read. But literature is not just valuable because it's heroic. That can be why you individually like literature, is like you really want the heroic element, that's really important to you. But that's certainly, for me, that's not super important. And that's okay. I'm actually looking for this experience of living a life through another person, and I'm interested in these kinds of the conflicts that they face and exposing human nature in this way. And naturalistic literature can oftentimes do that really, really, really well, even if it's not heroic.
I had a question of mine, but I like Tom Jones's question in the chat much, much better. Is microaggression a real concept?
But by the way, put that in my notes so that I have that. Thank you. I think there's certain things that, for one, I just hate the term because it's this leftist invention of of categorizing things that are actually not aggression as aggression by calling them microaggression. But on the other hand, there is such a thing as nasty, small, passive-aggressive behavior, where people are behaving in this way that is clearly designed to make you feel unwelcome and stupid and whatever, you know, whatever else it might be, stupid and wrong, but is not so overt as to be clearly an insult and clearly aggressive. So yes, that kind of thing happens. But I hate the whole concept of microaggression.
But you know, I think in a lot of cases, it's also meant to describe things that aren't even passive aggressive. So for example, some of our questions earlier, right? Like presumed a certain heteronormative context,
right?
And a lot of people would regard that as a microaggression because, you know, but what about the gays?
Right.
You know what I mean? And so it's...
Yeah, that's why I think it's this, like, it's like a package deal. It's a kind of junk concept because it's classifying things that are these, like, passive-aggressive kinds of exclusionary things that people would do that are deliberate and intentional, or at least, I mean, maybe not deliberately intentional, nasty, mean, but the person has some kind of wrong intent there. With stuff of that kind, stuff that might just be like maybe a little bit, I mean, maybe at most a little bit insensitive. And that I don't like packaging those things together.
Yeah, insensitive is not the same thing as microaggression.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
You feel like we have time for one more?
Yeah, sure.
Does the counterintuitiveness of the Monty Hall problem demonstrate an inherent flaw in the human capability
to reason? I think I answered this one.
Did you?
Last week, maybe? Yeah, I think. Sorry, I didn't take it out of the queue.
Oh. Pity.
Yeah.
I'll have to go back and listen to that one. That was the week of your the debacle.
Oh yes. Oh God. Yeah.
Yeah. Let's see here. Let's see what I can find.
She asked me whether there's any normative propositions that are axiomatic. Because if that's not a technical question, I don't know what it is.
Yeah, all right, that's a good one.
Okay.
Let's do that.
Okay. So an axiomatic concept or an axiomatic proposition is something that is it's universally true, it's fundamental to all of human knowledge, it is cannot be denied without being implicitly asserted. So basically if you deny it, you're contradicting yourself. And I think there's another criteria or two in there.
So like it's implicit in everything?
Yeah, it's implicit in all knowledge. And so that's what something that's axiomatic is. A normative proposition is something that just says what ought to be. So you can say, like, the Lara bars in the cabinet ought to be organized, and that's a normative proposition. They shouldn't be, like, just in a box willy-nilly like they are in my pantry.
Yeah, I mean, that's also a category of descriptive.
Well, so if you say the descriptive statement would be the Lara bars in my pantry are in a box willy-nilly. So that's the descriptive statement that I would say, and Arthur would say that's wrong, and that's a normative proposition. So normative propositions, the way we get to those is by recognizing a ton of facts about the conditional nature of life and the fundamentality of this alternative of life versus death, and then we see that this has implications. These are the fundamental basis for the concept of value, the concept of good and bad, is based on its impact on the well-being of the organism and so on. And the result is then a bunch of normative propositions of various kinds. You have your fundamental ethical ones, you have more derivative ones, and so on. Those cannot possibly be axiomatic. They are not implicit in all knowledge. And the part of the way we know that is because there's such a long reasoning chain to get to them, to even get to any normative propositions whatsoever, that you are actually doing a ton of reasoning, and therefore they cannot possibly be implicit in all knowledge and so on. You might say that there's a way in which they might be like implicit in all action, something like that, but...
You know, and yeah. there's...
there's a sense in which, like, they have to be self-evident, right? Axioms are in a way self-evident. And that's not true of normative propositions. I can imagine, depending on what the person meant when they asked this question, right, they might think of things that are just the very basis of ethics in the first place, like you should be self-interested, right? And even that doesn't necessarily strike me as properly axiomatic in the same way that, like, the law of identity is.
Yeah, no, it's not. It's not implicit in all knowledge. It's not, you know,
right.
It's you can deny that without contradicting yourself, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, but I do think there's also a different use of the word axiomatic, which basically means that a thing serves as the basis for everything in a given field.
Right.
So, for example, mathematics has a certain set of axioms, right? Or you can even talk about axioms within just the delimited scope of ethics, right? If you want to say, like, these are basically the kinds of things that we're taking for granted as the indisputable basic facts or truths from which all further reasoning will proceed, like, I think there's a way in which you can call that those things axioms in that context, but you're kind of being loose with your terminology.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
Yeah. I tend not to like that. And in ethics,
if
you look at ethics in total, ethics consists of three major parts. So it's meta-ethics, which is how you're justifying your ethical theory. Normative ethics, which is the sort of fundamental principles of that theory. You're fleshing those out. And then there's applied ethics, where you're taking much more derivative issues and figuring out what your ethical theory says about those kinds of cases. And, like, even something like self-interest is moral or a person ought to be self-interested, that's certainly not even axiomatic in this loose sense in meta-ethics. Like, you might take that for ethical theory, or sorry, not ethical theory, for normative ethics and for applied ethics, but that's exactly what's the question in meta-ethics. So, yeah, and I don't tend to like, particularly because objectivism has this very specific technical meaning of axiomatic, and then it's also used in a slightly in a rather different but also very technical sense, say in mathematics. I don't like using it in this loose sense. I think that's not clarifying.
I agree.
Yeah.
But, you know, it can be helpful to know what people might mean by it, because,
yes,
you know, just because someone says the word axiom doesn't mean that they're using it in the very precise way that we know.
Right.
And there might be something to gain or understand from someone else's usage.
Absolutely.
All right.
Moving on.
It's time for us to sign off from another episode of Philosophy in Action Radio. Thanks for listening. We hope you had a great time.
I had a fantastic time. Once again, thank you to our generous contributors. With every episode of Philosophy in Action Radio, we bring you ideas that engage the mind and help you live better. Plus, we introduce thousands of other listeners to the principles they need to live virtuous, happy, and free lives. We think that's hugely important, and we do depend on your support. So if you want to contribute, just go to philosophyinaction.com/support.
Remember, we welcome feedback on what we're doing well and what we could do better. Email all of that to diana@philosophyinaction.com.
If you do want to see what's on tap in the next few weeks, visit philosophyinaction.com/upcoming.
I'm Arthur Zay, and you can find me on Twitter @LogicalArthur. And on Facebook. This show features Dr. Diana Brickle, and you can read her blog Noodle Food at philosophyinaction.com/blog. Please drop by to submit and vote on questions for upcoming shows, and then join us live here at the same time next week at Philosophy in Action.
Thanks, everyone. Bye.